I'll call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for, what's the day, Friday, April 24th. And Ms. Johnson's asked to make a brief statement to us, and let's start with that.
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, my name is Betty Johnson. I'm here as an advocate for improvement in the healthcare system in the state of Oregon. And my testimony is, first of all, that I want to thank each one of you for the tremendous job that you have done in these past few months. The time and energy and effort that you've put into House Bill 2009 is really remarkable. I think you've had a formidable job. More than 70 amendments is just mind-boggling to me. And I just can't thank you enough for the sincerity of your effort and the kind of diligence that you have in the way in which you pursued your task. And so the rose is a pretty small token, but it comes with a great big thank you.
Betty, thank you very much for your kind words.
I also want to thank the staff. They've done a good job.
And we're reserving a rose for the Legislative Council as well.
I should add that this is not from me personally. It represents a lot of advocates, Healthcare for All Oregon, Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates, and our partners in Portland and Eugene and Ashland. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, and Mr. Chair, we know who's been sitting in that front row for weeks on end. So.
Yeah. Making sure we didn't
Making
say
sure. Thank you, Betty.
Thank you. Okay. We have work to do today. We have several bills that will move on eventually to rules and other places. And let me, well, first let's do the real work. We have bills that we can actually work and move today. So I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 3204. And if you'll all take a look at that, would you talk about that bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is the bill on the limited access hygienist, I believe.
Yep, that's the one.
And at the public hearing, there was a request by the committee to see if the groups could go out and find an amendment that they could agree to. And they've done that, and that's the dash 3 that you have in front of you. I frankly haven't had time to look at it, or I would explain the effect of the amendment. Paul Cosgrove and
Mr. Cosgrove, could you work us through it, please? Margie here too.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove, representing Oregon Dental Hygienist Association, and joining me is
Margie Hoffman with the Oregon Dental Association.
And your staff was correct. The dash 3 amendments are, in fact, a compromise that was worked out between the two associations. And it also includes a grammatical correction in Section 2 of the bill, which we didn't spend much time on when this bill was heard, but there was a concern that, as originally drafted, some of the updating grammar done by Legislative Council's office might have changed the substance of the bill, and Legislative Council graciously decided to remove that grammatical updating and just insert the two words "in Oregon," which is how we submitted the amendment, and I think that was an issue for the board. As it sits in front of you, the dash 3 allows an LIP hygienist to qualify to apply for a permit in two different pathways, the current pathway plus a new one, which involves a course of study with 500 hours out in the community sites where they will be practicing. And there are a couple of additional procedures which hygienists perform, which an LAP hygienist will now be able to perform without supervision, and a couple that are part of a commitment that the two associations have made to study those issues further between now and February and hopefully bring you back a solution on those as well. And those were the two that on which you heard some dispute about, local anesthesia and temporary restorations. And the two associations will be working with all the other interested parties on that in the interim. So I think that as they sit, the Dash 3s do not have any opposition.
They're perfect.
I got to say, you guys are my heroes. You're the heroes of the of the scope of of the scope of practice battles. 2 years in a row, two sessions in a row, you guys have come together and worked out a compromise. Yeah, to which you have my applause.
Well, thank you. All of us. Couldn't be done without the great work that Marty does.
That's and I probably should add that this has a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. Can I have an amendment on, a motion on the Dash 3s, please?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3204.
Is there any discussion on the Dash 3s? Is there any objection? Dash 3s are moved.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3204 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion?
Did you say as amended?
As amended, yes.
Please call the roll.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Embro?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harper?
Aye.
Representative Hennemer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 3204 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who would like to carry it?
Actually, it's Tina's bill.
Yeah, it's I'd be happy to carry it.
Great. Representative Kotek carrying it. Now, if we can just do that with every other bill on the agenda, we'll get out before Saturday afternoon. Number two I had marked. Yeah. I'd close the work session on House Bill 3204 and open a work session on House Bill 2056. Where are we on this bill, Madam Administrator?
Well, we have a fiscal and a revenue on the Dash 2 amendment. This afternoon, we were also given a Dash 3 amendment. You have both of those amendments in front of you at the dais. The fiscal impact on this bill, you have a fiscal impact statement in front of you.
I see your copy of two
yes.
and threes.
Two and threes. Here's
two. I'm sorry.
That's okay. And basically what this bill does is changes the makeup and the number of some of the state boards.
And can I see the threes? The difference yes. between the twos and threes? Is there some discussion on this bill? We've had some discussion here. Somebody wants to raise some issues?
Can we have a description of the twos and threes, please?
Huh. Yeah, I'm trying to. There is one difference between the twos and threes. What both of them do is add one public member to every board. As a part of the discussion we've been working on this now about. Is that not correct? Tom, will you join us? We've been working on this, as you know, about 2 years now. And I'd like to move some of these things. Would you,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Powers, staff for the chair, you have before you House Bill 2056. You also have a Dash 1 in front of you. I believe there has been submitted a Dash 1 and a Dash 2. Those are the two that are counterparts, in a sense, where they add one member to every board listed in the original bill. The Dash 3 amendments are provided to you by the Oregon Nurses Association and Mr. Dempsey, whereby there are in this set of amendments, all boards are required to add enough members to get them to two public members, which basically has the effect of every board in the bill would stay the same, or would add one, except for the nursing board, which already has two. This is my quick reading of these amendments, which I just got this afternoon. The difference between the dash ones and the dash twos are that the dash ones have a certified nursing assistant added to the board of nursing as well as public member, whereas the dash twos only put a public member on each across the board without a certified nursing assistant.
Jack, are you here?
And Felisa is Ms. Higgins is the. This pretty much the sponsor of the dash ones with SEIU Local 49.
Tell me what the dash threes do.
Mr. Chair, Jack Dempsey with the Oregon Nurses Association. What the dash threes do is say that every health licensing board has to have at least two public members, period. Then there is another piece of it that on the nursing board, one of the LPNs, there's currently two LPN positions, one of those is removed and a CNA position is added.
Okay. And the dash, which is the one that simply adds one member to each board?
Those are the dash two amendments, Mr. Chair. And
here's what I would like to have happen. We're getting into two thorny issues with the ones and the threes. I believe I heard from almost every board who objected to what we were finding before, it's okay to add one member, but don't take away anyone. I think I'm hearing now, not necessarily from the board, but from the association, that that's not the route you want to go in the nursing, and I think we've heard from SEIU that they want to change it. My preference is to amend in the dash twos that simply has one member, send it over to the Senate and let them decide whether they want to pass it or not pass it or modify it. But we've had this battle. It's late in the session, and my preference would be we move it this way. There'll be lots of time over there to take it up.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could just speak to the dash three, because I think the dash three really accomplishes everything that we want to accomplish. The challenge that we were facing was boards where there was just one public member and who was kind of out there as a singleton, subject to potential groupthink. I mean, that was the fear. And I think that this dash three amendment, by ensuring that there are two public members on each board, is going to really deal with that problem. Plus, it deals with the CNA. It brings the CNA onto that nursing board, which for me is a huge priority.
Representative Denver, who's the we that was trying to get two on each board?
Well, I think that, as I recall the discussion around, adding board members, I think that's what I recall hearing a lot of on the part of the board.
Just checking, because my interest was to get a majority of the board members, public members, on all boards. I backed off that and came up with the notion of getting 50% minus one on each board, because I don't think two is enough on the large boards, and I had specific communication from a nursing board member who was one of two who felt being only two in a large board was not sufficient to get the attention. And my understanding is if you have a minimum of two, Tom said it will change every board, but there are lots of boards now that have two, aren't there?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. That's just in the printed bill for boards that do not already have two public members. There are quite a few that only have one right now, including, let's see here, the Board of Dentistry currently has one member. The Board of Direct Entry Midwives has no public members as of right now. The Physical Therapist Licensing Board has one public member. And so this would change only a handful of the licensing boards.
The effect of the dash two would add one to every one. Is that right?
Yes, so that, Mr. Chair, that's correct, so that there would be an additional public member on the Board of Dentistry, where you would go from one to two, as well as on boards such as the Oregon Medical Board and the Oregon State Board of Nursing, where we go from 2 to 3. However, on boards where you have the 50% minus 1 ratio currently intact, such as the Licensed Board of Clinical Social Workers, I believe that's a 4 to 3 public or professional public ratio, that would not change.
That doesn't change.
And Mr. Chair, I will say that I think the dash 3s would make it more standard if that's what your goal is, to get 2 on each. Because the boards that currently have 2 go to 3, the boards that have 1 go to 2, and you still don't have what I would argue is a standard, which I think is what you were arguing for all along to do on these boards.
Not in this one, it wasn't. My goal in this one, you want to know what my goal was, is to have a majority of public members. I've temporarily given up that goal for this session.
We have a short recess.
Yep, let's stand at ease. Back in a work session. I guess I would like the comments of the board on the alternative of the 2 and the dash 3 amendments. I'd like to find out where you guys are in a straightforward, you're great Americans, tell me what you want, and we'll go with the majority of the committee.
Yep. I guess my view is that these
or neither is another option.
My view is these are professional boards, and much of what they deal with is technical, and I think it's appropriate to have a majority of the people be the profession from which the board represents. I think I could live with the dash threes at 2 apiece. That I think that's good. After that, I have trouble getting to a majority, either a larger number or a majority.
So none of them would have a majority.
Yeah, I know, but that was the original goal.
Oh, yeah, that goal hasn't changed.
So I would support the dash twos.
Other comments? Support the dash threes.
Or threes, excuse me, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
It is Friday afternoon.
Yes, and then Mr. Thompson?
Threes.
I would support 3. I think it moves us in the right direction. Next session, you can add one more.
I never thought of that. Go to amendment 4. Good.
Is that the truth?
Mr. Chair.
How about a motion on the threes?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash threes to House Bill 2056.
Any discussion on the dash threes? Any objections to the dash threes? See how flexible I am? Isn't that great? I wish everybody around here was that flexible. Motion on the bill as amended, please.
I don't have a fiscal on the dash threes, but we have it on the dash twos. You could suspend the rules.
The dash two.
Because presumably
I would ask for suspension of the rules because adding fewer members can't possibly cost more than adding more members. I will deem it a de minimis impact, if anything, and I'll ask for a motion to suspend the rules to... this is going to Ways and Means anyway, right? Is it?
No.
And what was the fiscal on the... the dash twos?
Basically, it says it depends on the number of public members currently on a health regulatory board. It said most agencies estimate a minimal fiscal impact from the requirements of this bill.
Okay. And I would say let's move it. Let's have a motion to suspend the rules, please. Move it to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I request unanimous consent to suspend the rules to permit House Bill 2056 as amended to the floor.
Okay. Is there any objection to that motion?
Without a... Well, it only takes two-thirds.
But we'll have unanimous anyway.
We have unanimous.
Yep. No objection to that. Now a motion on the bill itself, please.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2056 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Mm-hmm. Is there any discussion? Any more discussion? Mm. Please call the roll.
Whose bill is this?
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dembrough?
Aye. It's committee bill.
Representative Garrick?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Hanover?
Aye.
Committee. Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion carries. Somebody like to carry this? Who hasn't? I'll be happy to, but who hasn't? Who's anybody not carried a bill so far?
Interim committee.
Our bill. The good vice chair.
You? I'll carry it.
I'll take it.
You got it? Okay. Yes. Representative Harker carries it. Good work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And in the interim, you'll have my motion to move to a majority of each one. tell me, what was the third one?
That we could move?
Yep.
Well, we can move 3236, 2552.
Yeah, let's go to 2552. Yes. I'm going to close the work session on 2056 and open a work session on 2552. We need to move this one to Ways and Means if we are going to move it. We have a fiscal on it. Would you tell us about the bill and about the fiscal?
This bill basically requires that spousal support or child support be disregarded when calculating the eligibility for medical assistance. There is a dash one amendment to this bill, and it requires that the DHS apply for any type of federal approval that may be required under the bill, and that the bill will become effective if the federal approval is given.
Okay, and this is going to Ways and Means, is that right?
No, not.
Is it going to the floor?
Yes, but it's going to Ways and Means because of the letter that we requested. Because the fiscal on this was very high.
Yeah, it needs to go to Ways and Means.
Yes, and so we have requested a letter, and the speaker signed a letter referring it to Ways and Means.
Okay. So, do we need to amend this at all?
There was a dash one amendment that we need to adopt.
And what does the dash one amendment do?
The dash one amendment is the one that says that the DHS has to apply to the federal government for approval and that the bill becomes effective once federal approval or if federal approval is given.
That bill we just dealt with before, was that 2345?
No.
That was 2056.
No. Okay. I'm having trouble finding it on my scorecard.
First page. 2552.
No, I was trying to find the other. There it is. Okay. That's right. Okay. Is there any discussion on this bill?
So, Mr. Chair, question?
Uh-huh.
The dash one doesn't change the fiscal.
Actually, the dash one does change the fiscal.
We have a fiscal on the dash one.
Yeah. No, I'm looking at it. It's the same as the other.
It changes the general fund expenditure. The dash one increases the general fund obligation in the 09-11 biennium. Marginally, but it changes it.
So $1?
No. There's a difference of almost $16,000. Which is so not that.
This is the dash one. There's this difference.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see how we can't send it. We have a Ways and Means Subcommittee co-chair with us today. Well, I mean, I don't think it matters which it is. They both seem pretty significant.
You're right. It is bad.
It's just a mistake they made.
No, they don't make mistakes.
Sorry. New math.
They make challenges. You're right. Okay. Wow. Do you have a PhD?
Yes, he has two PhDs. What, Representative Kotick, we have permission to send this to Ways and Means. It seems to me there's no way not to with that.
It all is.
With that fiscal. Does it not seem that
way? Oh, no, it needs to come to
Subcommittee.
I was just, I guess I was misreading the dash ones. I thought this was somehow saying these changes wouldn't be made unless we got some federal approval, but that's not how these are written. This is an additional requirement requiring the department to apply for any type of federal approval, but it still requires them to go through with the change. Am I getting that right? I just was wondering, I thought maybe this was a way to remove the fiscal pending approval from the feds, but that's not the case here. It still has the same fiscal saying department do it, and by the way, also apply to the feds.
Apply for any, yeah.
Okay.
But that, Mr. Chair, that may be the way fiscal LFO has interpreted it, but it's certainly not the way I read the amendment, which would suggest in Section 2, Sub 2, that the amendments, that the rest of the bill only becomes operative upon approval by the feds. So one would have thought that would impact the fiscal.
This is, I think, the critical thing. May I read part of a letter from the Department of Human Services that I think explains the Dash 1 amendment, the need for the Dash 1 amendment? This is a letter from Department of Human Services, and it says, disregarding child or spousal support paid by all applicants or recipients of long-term care services will reduce the amount of income contributed toward the cost of care by clients, therefore increasing the amount paid by the department. Because this disregard is not allowed by federal regulations, the department's increased cost would not be eligible for federal matching funds, resulting in a total general fund expense. So the Dash 1 amendment is to get the federal approval to allow
waivers.
Basically to allow the waiver of the calculations, including the spousal and child support, and not lose the matching funds. I think that's the intent.
But, Mr. Chair, the problem with that is still, even though it's not activated unless the feds agree, more people will be eligible than under the current standard, which does not, which includes spousal and child support. So it's going to have a significant fiscal. It's got to go to Ways and Means.
Yeah, well, my view is that this is probably good policy, and we ought to send it to Ways and Means, and not to send it to Ways and Means to die, but to send it to Ways and Means for Ways and Means to figure out how this goes into the budget system, where there are a lot of problems. My guess is, in this budget situation we have, this is not going to get out of Ways and Means. But Kotek, do you have a guess on that? Or I mean, I don't mean you're going to have a guess because you're faced with the responsibility of doing it. And we've really been asked not to send things forward that we don't think is worth compared to other things like the huge cuts we're going to have compared to them. So I'm comfortable not to send it forward, but I think in a public policy perspective, it makes sense and it's fair. Would you comment for us on this?
I would agree with that. I won't speculate on its chances in the subcommittee. I think what would be helpful when we move it, if we are to move it to the subcommittee, is actually to hear, because what was interesting to me about this bill is that there was more than one legislator with more than one constituent dealing with this issue, and the ramifications of those issues, I think would be an interesting thing to point out for the subcommittee of what this means for those families when what they have to do to their family structure to be eligible for certain programs. And I think that's an interesting policy discussion in and of itself. I think we're limited by the feds not allowing us to do this to begin with, so I'm not sure how we would. I think we just need to, I need to read this some more, but I'd be happy to entertain if we could get it on the schedule. I think the challenge will be getting it on the schedule. We have lots of bills that we will have priority over this, but I'm not willing. I am willing to at least consider, you know, having a discussion in the subcommittee.
How about if we carry this over to Monday and give the... Yes, Representative Harker?
No.
No. How about if we carry this over to Monday and give us a chance to rethink it? And I think that our issue on this is not whether we think it probably makes sense. I think we think it does. So the question is... Do we prioritize it by not sending it over, or do we send it to the Ways and Means Sub and let us prioritize it there compared to other things?
Well, and Mr. Chair, if I may, I do think the instructions have gone to the policy committees that by sending something to Ways and Means, you want this to be a priority among the discussions if we were able to offset it with other dollars. And I would ask the committee, of all the things that we're considering in human services, does that rise to the level of needing consideration of Ways and Means? If the committee feels it does, then I think we should move it. If this is something that, though...
Great idea,
you know, it's a matter of, you know, what's the time of the subcommittee at this point, so...
Please, my question, this is really a human services question and not a health care committee question. And unfortunately, we can't move it back to human services.
But it would go to the human services sub, if that's, I mean, that's where it would go.
Priority? I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure how high this falls on the priority list, given all the other bad things that are going to happen.
I'm going to carry this over, and I'd really like you to give me some informal feedback. If the feedback is this is not high enough priority, we just will not open it on Monday and let it die. But give me some informal feedback as we go along. And that's, I will carry over House Bill 2552 to Monday and close the work session on 2552. Okay, we've noted that. Would you keep track of the things we're carrying over so we don't have to? I have said that is carried over now. I'd like to, we've had a request for having a, oh no, wait a minute, first.
We have more bills we can
yeah,
move.
We got 3236.
We have more than that.
Good. I'll open a work session on House Bill 3236. Representative Thompson, would you give us an update on where we are?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. 3236 is the bill we've been working that changes statute to allow pharmacists to deliver immunizations down to patients age 11 and above, aimed at increasing the rate of immunizations among the adolescent population, which we are, among others, one of the states that doesn't have a really high rate there. And that's, it's a national problem, but it's one that's been identified here, too. It spreads out the ability to deliver immunizations to that population, to pharmacists from all their practitioners, and it's hoped that we can get a better, you know, drive some better numbers by doing this. It puts Oregon kind of in the middle. Texas has no age restrictions on immunizations. Other states that have various ones. And this moves down from age 15 for flu vaccinations and age 18 for other vaccinations.
You have an amendment for us?
The -1 amendment, or -2 amendments, I'm sorry, do two things. It allows for a delay in the setting up the process to January 1st, 2011, because that gives DHS time to get it into their system, and there's a registry issue on getting pharmacists to feed into the alert registry. Right now, we have a Safeway Corporation into that registry on a kind of a trial sort of thing, but there was a problem with capacity, was my understanding, and trying to get everybody in right away. So there's a phase-up for that part of it to make that happen. And there's a part in the original bill that required pharmacists to register for the children's vaccine program and report through that, which is a Medicaid program. I ask that be taken out because it's a mandate on pharmacy providers that is not on other immunization providers. And I think we can get at that another route over the next year and a half by education and registration. Pharmacists aren't opposed to it, but it makes no sense to put a mandate for delivery on one group of providers that isn't shared by others. And that was my issue, not a pharmacy issue. Pharmacists were not unsupported.
And that's the dash twos.
Yeah.
We had a rather strongly worded letter from the OMA on this bill. I've been informed that after your discussions with the OMA, the OMA is now supportive of the bill.
Well, I'm not sure supportive is the right word. I think we talked about a number of the issues.
I actually received word that they support
the bill. Oh, well, I applaud that then, because I had hoped that we would receive that, but...
I think that's right, yeah.
Mr. Chair, as I read this, this would go into effect
January 1, 2011 is in the amendment.
And that would be true whether or not the registry actually comes online. Say something goes wrong with the registry.
I'm of the understanding that that won't be a problem, but I think it wouldn't make a lot of sense for pharmacists to take part in this if they couldn't be part of the registry in what we're trying to do. So I believe that the immunization people and the pharmacy group and whatnot working together will make this happen, or there's going to be a delay. There's lots of what ifs.
Dr. Lace, did I misstate your position on that? And can I have somebody from... Lorraine, do you want to comment on it, too, from your perspective, if you can join us?
Yeah.
Pardon me, or Jim? You want to let us know where you are now?
Chair Greenlich and representatives, my name is Lorraine Duncan, Immunization Program Manager for the Public Health Division. As I testified earlier, we were very much in favor of having a requirement for pharmacists to participate in the Vaccine for Children program, primarily because Vaccine for Children program covers 38% of the adolescent population in the state of Oregon. So it covers all children on Medicaid, children with no insurance, American Indian or Alaska Native. So if they don't serve that population, they wouldn't be serving 38%. And I think Representative Thompson has made it clear that they're not saying they won't participate. They don't want to have a requirement to participate. I think it's important to clarify that the community norm is to have a Vaccine for Children program, that 95% of the providers in Oregon, pediatricians, family practice, participate in the program.
Without a mandate to do so.
Without a mandate to do so. There is a mandate through DMAP, through the Medicaid program, and it basically says is that you cannot immunize a child in Oregon, a Medicaid child, unless you're enrolled in the VFC program. So if they send in a bill for the vaccine, they don't get paid, and they wouldn't get an administration fee.
So it doesn't say you can't vaccinate them. It says you can't bill for vaccinating them.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dr. Lace, did I overstate the OMA position?
No, I think this is an issue that's come up in numerous sessions. And I think at this point, as we move forward with our health care for all of Oregon's children, that's our last name for that, we realize that there are areas of the state that do not have primary care providers for these children. And we know that there are areas in the state that don't have access to, for the record, I'm Dr. Lace.
I'm sorry.
A pediatrician here in Salem. I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. So we do know that there's areas that do not have children, with access to that. So if we can improve the vaccination rate for these kids in the state, then we're in favor of that. One, you know, we had a good discussion yesterday, you know, talking about the medical home, integrated medical home concept that you have, or that
or something
you,
else,
whatever it's going to look something. Like. What we're going to talk about, you know, pediatricians have been doing that for a bazillion years already, but and we're happy to have everybody else come on board with us. But we just wanted to have an integrated system, and with the ability to use EHRs, you know, to actually have, if we say, you know, you can get your vaccine down there, they can send it back and say, yeah, they got it, and we can enter it into our database. That would be a huge leap forward, along with all these other management issues. So as long as the only request that I have is to make sure that if somebody's going to query the vaccine registry system to find out if that child needs whatever vaccine, they should put in that information also, because it defeats the whole purpose of the registry. And even if it's a pain in the butt, I don't care. You know, just do it. And so we talked about if, in fact, we're getting a lot of pushback, we come back in another session and mandate that all providers, including the doctors and nurse practitioners, anybody else in the state that's doing the vaccines, they have to, you know, register and make sure that those vaccines are recorded in there. So I think we addressed most of those concerns, and I think that we can, you know, go along with the bill now.
Okay,
so,
thank you both.
Yeah.
Can I have a motion on the dash twos?
Before that, I'd like to make a statement that on the record. This has been a very contentious issue, because as we move into healthcare reform, we're playing around the edges of practice standards and all kinds of things. And this, as you know, Mr. Chairman, has gone on for some time. The OMA and the immunization people at DHS have been absolutely incredible to work with. And through the various versions of this bill and direction, and of course we'll be continuing to work together over the next year and a half, but this is a real success story to get practitioners to come to the table, you know, look for the public benefit out of something, and then give and take to make it work. And I strongly feel that the pharmacy community will meet the obligations of professional providers, and we're gonna really move ahead on this.
Great. Now are you ready for the motion?
I'm ready for the motion.
I was afraid you had six votes and we're going for five.
Mr. Chair, I see we need to move the amendment first, don't we?
Yes.
I move that we move the dash twos into House Bill 3236, dash twos dated 41509.
Is there any discussion?
I'll wait to the full bill.
Okay. Is there any objection? So moved. Now a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move House Bill 3236 to the floor.
For the due pass recommendation.
With the due pass recommendation.
As amended. As amended with the dash.
As amended, yes. I'm sorry. I'm new at
this. We have a motion on the floor to move House Bill 3236 as amended with the dash twos to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do support, I will be voting in support of the bill as amended, because I'm pleased to see the implementation date moved out. I think they had a very valid concern from public health about making sure the alert registry was ready for the inclusion of this additional set of providers. That being said, I would actually urge some work on the Senate side to clarify if the alert system is not up and running by the time the operation, there should be some safeguard there that we don't want pharmacists starting to do the vaccines, but then no system to be there. It makes no sense not to be tracking those kids.
That's reasonable.
I hear what the department is saying about wanting to expand the Vaccine for Children program. I'm hoping that there'll be an incentive for pharmacists who want to be able to get reimbursed for OHP kids, that they will, you know, voluntarily get into the program, but I think we're going to have to come back and see how that's working. And lastly, I would hope that the pharmacist, the pharmacy association would enter into discussions with the department about participating financially in the support of ALERT. That's a public-private partnership, especially we have a lot of pharmacists coming on board. I think that could help with the sustainability of the ALERT system, so I hope we can consider that. And I just want to thank the representative for the good work on working on the amendment, so thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, are we ready to vote? Please call the roll.
Representative Nembro?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 3236 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Will you carry that for us, Representative Thompson?
Mr. Chair. If you would indulge me one more moment, I didn't want to affect the vote, which I was hoping was going to be good, but being we are the Health Care Committee, I thought you might be interested in knowing that a week or so ago, the Oregon State Pharmacy Association was awarded the first ever annual partnership category for in recognition of extraordinary contributions toward improving our nation's vaccination rates and the role of pharmacies in public health. And this partly came to the association because of the cooperation with Lorraine Duncan and her people and the good work that's been going on. And it was all in spite of my leadership over the past 3 years.
Well, fortunately, they took care of that. Right?
That's right. I'm not there anymore. That's what made it happen. You know.
Jim, congratulations. That is good news for the pharmacists of the States. And we have Tom Holt in the background who used to do
work working for... It started back then.
Representing the association, I think he was very instrumental in helping that move forward, and I think he deserves a piece of that,
yep.
of that recognition.
Absolutely.
We have closed that session. I've had a request to know if we are going to work 2118 today. We do not have the fiscal that goes with 2118, so those of you that may be waiting around to deal with that, I will tell you, I am now, carrying over 2118 and till Monday, and you all can leave. I'm going to be carrying over several that I'll get to in a while, but if anybody else is waiting to testify on a bill that we may or may not be working or to be here available, send me a note and I'll announce before you have to wait till 2 minutes to six to find out whether your bill is going to be worked or carried over today. Which one? Okay. Close the work session, if I haven't, on House Bill 3236. I know I can't reopen once. Oh, I can, but I can close it twice. Right? Okay. It's closed. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2755. We have a fiscal on it. Would you describe the bill and tell us what the fiscal says?
Yes, this is the bill that Representative Nathanson introduced, sponsored, and the original bill required the Department of Consumer and Business Services to conduct a study of reinsurance alternatives for individual and small employer group health insurance markets. Now, there was a -1 and a -2 amendment to this bill, both of which this committee has already adopted. There is a fiscal on this bill. You have it in front of you. DCBS estimates no fiscal impacts from the requirement of the bill. They and DHS are going to pursue federal grant funds. And DCBS estimates that they can absorb this within their budget. And there's Representative Nathanson.
Welcome, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have any comments to help us on this?
I know that, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. I know that you all are trying to process lots of information, so I'm not going to repeat the purpose of the bill other than it's to take a first step in trying to understand what is causing the escalating costs of health insurance. Reinsurance being part of that, it would study reinsurance to see if there are viable concepts to help reduce the increase in cost. I'm delighted to see that we have agencies not only prepared to, but willing and interested in working on this solution. So I hope that you will see find that it's a favorable idea to take one piece and start working on it now.
Can I have a motion on 2755, please?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2755 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnamer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Excused. I'm sorry. He's off celebrating. Can he do the Macarena?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Devereaux?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion carries. Would you carry the burden of taking to the floor for us?
I would be most pleased. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nathanson will carry it on the floor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your work on this one, Representative Nathanson. I'm going to, if I can keep my scorecard here, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3258. Do we have a public testimony request? I'm going to ask you to keep it very brief. Let me tell you what I hope to do after we've heard.
Is it 3258?
Mm-hmm. 3258. Okay. We have a group of people, 2 minutes each, with your heartfelt testimony. I don't see anybody. Oh, we have one person testifying against, it looks like, and we will hear that. The one person testifying against can have 3 minutes. There's only one person. Can we have Jeff Hetherington, Patty Kinney, Rachel Pilliode, is that? Pilliode. Okay. Can we have you all?
It's not just on those.
Patty Kinney?
I think they're just grabbing him from outside.
Okay. We'll call him in a minute. 2 minutes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president of Family Care, which is, we're the oldest Oregon health plan company here in the state, and I'm also the chair of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, which represents about 75% of the FCHIPs here in Oregon. House Bill 3258 is part of our legislative package that we drafted to address what we consider to be a problem with the Oregon Health Plan. We also think it's a problem across the state, and that is the shortage of primary care physicians. You know, this is the start of the process in terms of trying to enhance the primary care workforce, and it starts with the debt that the students have to shoulder once they get out. That debt is climbing. You hear different stories. The one I've heard is around $175,000 per each student. Taking that into the lowest paid specialty into practice is very difficult, and so this is one of the ways that we think we can incentivize people who want to go into family practice and just find that they can't afford it in the long run, that this will help them move into that area. The one thing I would say about this bill is there are a number of what I would call technical changes that were made in drafting.
He's got a cell phone, but
time's out. Technical changes that have been submitted to clean up some of the language to make it more Oregon-specific, and a few administrative changes in the bill. So this isn't final form, and we've been working with Representative Kotek's office to have those drafted.
Do we have an amendment?
We do. It has not come out.
Okay, and we want to wait for the amendment, is that right?
No, we don't want to wait for the amendment.
Well, we get to wait.
Yeah.
Somebody seems to have a cell phone that's working. It's probably a BlackBerry.
It's got a satellite.
Please turn them off. Yes.
I think Patty, do you want to go ahead and go next?
Who's next?
Yeah.
Go for it.
representatives.
2 minutes.
My name is Patrick Kenny. I'm a third-year medical student from OHSU. I guess briefly, my story. I came to medical school to go into rural primary care. I grew up in a town of 5,000 in Alaska. The practice that I see myself in is in clinic and in the hospital. I plan on delivering babies, doing primary C-sections, office procedures, covering the emergency room, the whole nine yards. In short, I believe that I'm probably the doctor that you guys are aiming to recruit with this bill.
Northern exposure, right?
Yeah. Kind of like that, yeah. I haven't decided where I'm training, and I've got strong ties to this state, too, as well. My family has a cattle ranch over north of Sisters. I guess what I would like to say on this is, again, strongly support the intention behind this bill. I'm going to graduate with over $200,000 worth of debt. And I would, of course, like a portion of that debt repaid by going into a poorly compensated field, but what I think is going to be a very fulfilling career. My concern with this bill is the reason why I chose not to take a National Health Service Corps bill, which is kind of an analogous program to this, and that is medical students, when they enter medical school, are like stem cells. We are pluripotent. We can become all kinds of doctors, and we do become all kinds of doctors. And even though I actually came into medical school with a better idea than most of what I wanted to do, I wasn't 100% sure that I was going to end up in primary care, that I wouldn't rotate through a surgical subspecialty and be swept off my feet.
Toxicology was just too much fun to pass.
That's right. That's right. I have adult clinical urology at the Veterans Hospital next year, so we'll see how that goes. But I wasn't willing to make that commitment. I wasn't willing to take on the potential of that risk and having to pay back punitive. So I feel that this money would be better spent in a loan repayment situation. Not to mention the fact that you get immediate benefit. That money that you're putting out, you are paying for doctors there in the field rather than waiting for people 7 years down the pipeline when they continue their training. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rachel Pilliard. I'm a first-year medical student, so I've completed about 9 months of my medical training, which makes me about 9% of the way done, and also at the very bottom of the food chain, as well as one of your pluripotent stem cells. In choosing to come to OHSU, I decided on the academic excellence and the reputation for focusing on primary care. What I didn't expect was the really high levels of stress and anxiety that I have as I get these quarterly reports about the amount of money that I'm taking out. As a student at the University of Oregon, I was able to get scholarships and to work part or full-time to graduate without any debt. And even though I've been fortunate to receive some awards at OHSU, I still am anticipating graduating with over $250,000 worth of debt.
You'll get there.
My classmates and I often joke that it's like we're living on Monopoly money because we just, at this point, cannot fathom how we're going to pay it off. But at least it's a source of entertainment at this point. Although we started with a very lofty sense of ideals about helping people and changing the world, I think most of us really do consider how much specialties pay versus primary care practices and how we're going to pay off the house we're essentially building in our minds, because that's the amount of money that we're putting into our education. To that end, I'd like to echo what Patty has said about the idea of supporting this bill very much and enthusiastically, and thank the sponsors, but also to say that it might be more effective as a loan repayment program. It certainly appeals to me more as a loan repayment program, simply because I would not want to risk a penalty not knowing exactly what field I might go into at this point, and I would never want to limit my options at this stage in the game. It's part of the joy and excitement of medical school that absolutely everything is available to you, and you get to try it all, and you may have an idea of where you want to go. I'm very interested in primary care. I've been at a clinic out in Scappoose, which has been very entertaining, highly enjoyable. So in short, thank you very much. I really appreciate the effort that's gone into this, and we look forward to working with you on this in the future.
Are you building that house in your mind of that plastic surgeon down in Ashland?
We've had some time.
Okay.
Okay, are there any questions of these folks? Thank you very much.
It's his wife.
Kat, do you want to testify as well? Come on. Susan King? Oh, there you are. Yes.
So, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Kat Livingston. I'm a family physician, and I'm currently a family medicine resident and a preventive medicine resident, and as many of you know, working as an intern with Representative Greenlick. But I think anything that we can do in the state to increase primary care providers is essential. Anything that we can do to attract more people, to make this profession more desirable, is really important. There's really good evidence that the more primary care that's available, and when people have continuity of primary care, you save money, people are healthier, and it's just better for the system in general. In terms of this bill in particular, I think it offers a great opportunity for people who have made that decision early. And I think that if people make that decision in their first year, they should have the ability to get that medical school loans available to them all 4 years. If they aren't ready to make that commitment until their third or fourth year, then that's fine. But I think that some people will be able to make that commitment in their first year, and they should be rewarded for that because they've made a commitment earlier. And it's a big deal to say you want to stay for 5 years in Oregon working as primary care, and I think that if someone knows that they're going to do that for 4 years in medical school, you should reward that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. King. I haven't seen you as much this session as we have.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, Susan King, Oregon Nurses Association. I'm just here to advise the committee that we are going to be asking for amendments that will also include nurse practitioners. I echo the sentiment that we have an inadequate primary care capacity at this point, and that's certainly something that we are committed to improving. We recently finished a survey. We're in the process of analyzing it of over 500 existing nurse practitioners in the state of Oregon. And 49%, it's not mine, it's in the back of the room, 49% of them currently practice in primary care. And we think by passing a bill such as this and including nurse practitioners, we can ensure that at least 50% and perhaps more of our future nurse practitioners remain in primary care. It's going to take physicians, nurse practitioners, and others if we're going to turn the corner and really make universal health care a reality for everyone in the future. Thank you.
I couldn't agree more. I would certainly support that amendment. Ms. King, can I ask you a question?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah. And is that amendment ready to go? I mean, do we have it? Or
no.
Mr. Coe, take care. Can we handle that in Ways and Means? I expect we could. Yeah, no. Yeah.
My question is also about prorating. And because back to the point that the young someday to be doctors is that they don't want to make the decision, you know, first year medical student, second year, but at some point they may be ready to make that decision, and you know, a year for a year commitment, you know, kind of a prorated commitment versus how much is paid for. Would you entertain that concept also?
We don't have.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah. Should ask you.
I as well. I think that's something.
Actually, you need to come up. I apologize.
Please reintroduce yourself.
Again, Patrick Kinney, Chairman Greenlick, and the rest. I think that would be something worth looking into. I'm sure most of you don't know the structure of medical school. I didn't before I started. But everybody kind of does the same thing for the first 2 years. For years 3 and 4, we rotate through. The third year, we do 5 weeks in the major core areas of medicine, and then the fourth year is more tailored towards what you either may be going into or what you know you'll never see again in 4 week blocks. So by the end of the third year, people have kind of been through most areas of medicine, and at least most of us, I would say about 70%, have pretty much made up their mind when they're sitting in my seat right now going into my fourth year. I would be interested in taking advantage of a program like that next year, yes.
That's your question?
That was my question.
Good. Yes, yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry I had to step out of the room, but I apparently missed a conversation about an amendment for nurses. I know when we were considering this bill as an amendment to 2009, we had restructured it significantly to make sure we were covering nurse educators and nurse practitioners, trying to get at both the primary care physicians and the nurses. I thought we ran into some problem about amending this bill because of the relating clause. And so because it relates to medical education for primary care physicians, I'm still open to considering that, but I'm thinking what we might need is if the chair is willing to send us a vehicle to Ways and Means, if he has one still available, if we wanted to amend this to make sure everybody could get in, we might need a different vehicle in the subcommittee. So I just want to point that out for folks.
Yeah, I'm not sure we do.
I don't have any suggestions, but I know this is important to folks. I think we're a little hamstrung by the relating clause, but I think when we were trying to put this in the 2009, we wanted to have both docs and nurses covered by this.
Well,
what we will end up being a loan repayment program.
Yeah. Okay.
Dennis
Johnson? We have written testimony from Laura Sislak of the Oregon Primary Care Association supporting it. We'll note that for the record.
Yes, sir.
Very good. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Johnson, Executive Director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And while I certainly, I think like most Oregonians, support the goal of this effort, it's the means that I'm concerned about. This is a time when dollars are very short, and a loan forgiveness program simply does not give the state as much bang for its buck as a loan repayment program. The two young medical students mentioned how a loan repayment program would help them. And that is what we have seen, certainly at the commission, to be very effective. Now, the fact of the matter is, of course, with a forgiveness program, the state has to front the loan capital and then has to be in the loan collection and tracking business for, it can be 20 years for one promissory note. We're just getting out of that at the commission. We have done a wonderful job and love the loan repayment programs we work with. They do give the state options to target funds strategically. We have one program that targets them geographically. You can target them by specialty. There are many different ways that the state can get a tremendous return on its investment. And there are even ways to provide incentives at the front end with repayment programs. But I guess the key is I would advise against the bill as it is written now with the forgiveness provisions and rather encourage you to consider a repayment program if the funds are available.
Mr. Chair, aren't these funds separate from... I think that this establishes a loan fund that can receive public and private funds. Is that correct? And that would be the source of these loans?
Well, we need...
Primary care medical education loan fund consists of money received by the OSAC from any public or private source for the purpose of awarding student loans.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Harker,
can you see where I'm going?
Yes, I can see a blend of funds here from public and private sources. The principles, I believe, still remain that the state, these private investors, will get more bang for the buck with a repayment program and targeting where this where we would like to see practitioners serve the citizens of Oregon, and perhaps in what specialties, that kind of thing. Much better return on investment with a repayment than with a forgiveness program.
So you're not arguing with the principal. You're saying one is you loan them the money, and then you have to get it back, or you waive it. I mean, I suppose if you loan them the money and then waive it, it's not a problem. If you loan them the money and then don't waive it, it gets to be a problem.
Mr. Chair, either way, you're maintaining that promissory note and tracking each individual loan for, as I said, perhaps up to 20 years. The repayment, it relies on other sources. You can have a loan program. Any institution can have its own loan program, but federal and state, there are other federal sources, of course, and private sources for the loans. You can rack up quite a bit. But if you know that you have, if you practice and you know you're going to get that loan repaid, that's different from having the forgiveness, the principal subtracted. And then if you don't complete the service, sometimes we have repayment of forgiveness, and it gets very, very complicated. So a straight repayment program is much cleaner, easier to understand, easier to administer, and gets better return.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a loan repayment program in statute already that we can refer LC to? So, because this wasn't clear when we were trying to draft this.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, yes, the Rural Health Services Loan Program, which we're working in cooperation with the Office of Rural Health right now, is a good model of this kind of thing. We have an advisory committee of health practitioners who really look over our shoulders, tell us we think these would be the best candidates from all these applicants, and we target that by geographic area, by communities. There are other provisions in that, but the mechanics of that would be a very good model.
Great. Thank you.
Is it appropriate to send this on to Ways and Means to straighten it out there if we're talking about supporting the principal? I've already talked to the Ways and Means chair on this one, and I have informed them that if we move it out of here today, it will go to Ways and Means with our strong support. It'll either go to the Education Subcommittee, I assume, or to Human Services. But we can begin to perfect it there if there is the money. My guess is this is not going to be the year to have the money for this, and I was reluctant to send it along until I had a sense that there was some money, but I think it is appropriate, and so does the House co-chair of Ways and Means, to get it there and have it available, and if they find money, then I think they can. Representative Kotek and others will help straighten it out. But I hear what you're saying, and it's noted for the record.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, thank you. Can I just interrupt for a second? I've had a request to hear whether, I can't do it right now. In a minute, I'm going to carry over House Bill 3227 and handle it on Monday. We do not have the material we need to pass it. I'm sorry, 3228. The varnish and whatever it is, Bill. So if anybody was waiting to work 3228, you don't have to do that anymore. Return on Monday, and as soon as I close this work session, I will announce that officially.
Okay. Did you open the work
session? No, we're still in a work session now.
Yeah. I just heard you open public hearing. I wasn't sure you opened a work session.
Oh, no. I did just open a public hearing. Yeah, we are in public hearing. Close a public hearing on House Bill 3258 and open a work session on... wait a minute. Close a work session. I will now announce we are carrying over House Bill 3228 until Monday. So put that on the carryover list.
Okay.
3228 carried over till Monday.
And Representative Thompson.
Open a work session, is that?
Mm-hmm.
You open a work session on House Bill 3258. Senator Thompson, did you?
Well, I was just going to comment, Mr. Chair. I would hope that in the interim, we can find time to put into this whole idea of professional education funding in medicine. It's a real quagmire, and it's going to be a huge impetus or obstacle to us getting where we want to be with community health delivery. I just went through this with my daughter-in-law, who's a dentist, and you know she's committed to community dentistry, but in her third year, she had some opportunities for orthodontia dangled in front of her that I would have preferred she took because of what it means to my old age retirement home. But, she stuck it out. But if we're going to have primary care providers, we're going to have to find a way to supplement that and support those people, or we simply aren't going to have them. They can't. The dollars don't mesh between what they make and what they owe, and we need to find a way to address that.
Yeah, I'm hoping that the authority that you voted against will actually get implemented and that they can take some work on that in the next year.
I supported the concept.
Yeah,
I voted against the specific.
I'm not going to forget that.
I know you're not.
Representative Bruin.
Mr. Chair, there's a bill floating out there right now that came through the Education Committee that's meant toward higher education, including medical higher education, that proposes a work group, but the idea behind the work group is to study the merits of an alternative tuition system. And just real briefly for the record, the alternative tuition system would say for medical students like these, instead of incurring $250,000 in debt, that they would agree contractually to give 5 or 6% of their gross income for the next 30 to 40 years of their life to the institution that and if they're making $150,000 a year, it's 6% of that. If they're making $500,000, it's 6% of that.
Or making $20,000.
Or making $20,000.
Yeah. I think that would be very interesting. We can move this to Ways and Means.
There is a subsequent referral.
With a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, right?
Yes.
Can we do that with a suspension of rules?
You got to get it. Yeah.
We don't have to suspend it. Could you call just pass it out?
Two Ways and Means. We don't need to have a fiscal to do that?
Like indentured servitude.
You got to suspend the rules. Okay.
I've never requested.
Here's what I would like to do with this one. I would like to... We don't have an amendment, right? So I would like to have a vote to suspend the rules to allow this bill to be moved to Ways and Means.
Without a fiscal.
Without a fiscal, and then I would like to have a motion to move it to Ways and Means. So can I have the motion to suspend the rules, please?
A motion both without a fiscal and without a revenue.
Right. Okay. We don't have to worry about revenue with this one.
Mr. Chair, I request unanimous consent to suspend the rules to allow House Bill 3258 to be moved to Ways and Means without a fiscal or a revenue.
Is there any objection to that motion? Motion carries. Can I have a motion to move House Bill 3258 to Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3258 to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay.
With a due pass recommendation.
A due pass. Is there any discussion on that motion? Would you please call the roll, Laura?
Vice Chair Harper?
Aye.
Representative Kenimer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dembrow?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 3258 moves on to Ways and Means with some enthusiasm, but not a great deal of hope.
You never know.
One more thing. I do want to announce I'm not opening a hearing on House Bill 3251 and will not move it forward. Rest in peace. Please stand at ease for a moment. That was my take-home bill.
Oh!
We come back to life. We have some sign-up sheets on three bills that I intend to open a work session. I would like to open a work session and then close it and then move the bills to rules. Those will be House Bill 2006, 3260, and 3261. If somebody specifically would like to testify them on them before they move to rules, I have authorization to move them to rules and will do so. But I will take testimony on them if it is something that you would like to have happen. My preference would be not to, so I will open up the bills and find out what your preference is. Let's start with, I'll open a public hearing on 2006. I have Holt and Fiskum. If the answer is no, we'll move it on. If you want to say something, come on.
Mr. Chair, all we'd like to do is present a letter for the record, and we can do that in any way you choose.
Come and present a letter to the record.
Tom, you can come on up.
Mr. Chair, for the record, committee members, Dave Fiskum here for Providence Health System. In light of your time and the press of business and your intention to move House Bill 2006 to the Rules Committee, I do have a letter from Providence Health System raising questions about the bill signed by Russ Danielson, our Chief Executive Officer. And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to present that for the record, and I'd be pleased to read it into the record, but in light of where you're heading, I will give it to your staff for the record, if that's your pleasure.
I think you figured out where I'm heading. Yes.
Thank you.
Please give it to the staff. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2006, open work session on House Bill 2006, and request a motion to move that bill to rules with no recommendation.
With no recommendation?
No recommendation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move.
So moved.
Okay.
Is there any objection to that motion?
We've got
to
cut out some of the words.
Really? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Kramer?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dembrough?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harper?
Aye.
Chair Greenlake?
Aye. Motion carries. 3-2. 3260, that is, I think, right?
Two, no.
2006. Okay. On its way to rules. Close the work session on 2006. Open a work session on.
3260.
No, a public hearing. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3260. Same deal. Have Holt and Fiskum again.
Mr. Chair, was that 3260?
3261 is coming next.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be very brief knowing your direction for this bill. We have concerns that this would seem to set in motion some state action toward that would lead toward creating a report that would have a list of facilities to eliminate, and we think that's a pretty dramatic step to be taking and would be opposed to the bill, whether here or in rules. And we'd suggest the complexity of this at this point in the session may be best to let rest.
Mr. Fiskum, do you have a problem as to which facility would be on that list to eliminate?
Mr. Chair,
who do you represent?
For the record, Dave Fiskum from Providence Health System.
Yes.
As Mr. Chair, you well know, I have submitted again a letter for the record raising questions about this bill as well, important policy issues for this legislature to have considered. We will raise these questions and, again, oppose the bill in the Rules Committee, but knowing of your intent, I will let you read the letter on your own. But I wanted to submit it for the record, again, signed by the CEO of our system, Russ Danielson. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Close public hearing on House Bill 3260. Open a work session on House Bill 3260. I'd like a motion with no recommendation. Can I hear that?
So moved.
We have a motion from Representative Harker to move House Bill 3260 to the Rules Committee with no recommendation. We have authorization of the Speaker to do that. Is there any objection?
please call the roll.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kennemer?
Aye.
Chair Greenlight?
Aye. Motion carries. 3260 is on its way to the Rules Committee. I'm opening a public hearing. Closing the work session on 3260. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3261. Same deal. We have a few more interested in testifying on 3261.
We also have a number of letters to be read into the record.
Okay.
If you're going to take testimonies.
Would you be so kind as to do that? You guys would be first.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'll just go quickly first with your indulgence and indicate that this is a very important bill, again, for Providence Health System. For the record, Dave Fiskum here for Providence Health System. Do you have a letter, again, on this with some attachments relative to the issue of certificate of need? I would just say one quick thing to you. Chip Lazier from J.E. Dunn. Construction company is here behind me in the room, and we've worked with him in his role as a member of Associate General Contractors, another of our firm's clients, and he's prepared to testify today. So, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, he might come and join us at the witness table.
Thank you.
He is behind me, and he'll be on the way up. You can stay here, Tom. And
he has
a letter as well that I'll submit on his behalf for the record, and I think maybe it's best to let him speak first, and if Tom and I have some follow-up, I think we would like to make you aware when Chip is done about the status of this kind of issue over in the Senate, where Tom has led an effort to produce a work group solution that we'll apprise you of in a few moments. But, Mr. Chair, if you would allow Mr. Lazier to go first, that would be helpful. Thank you.
It'd be my pleasure. Just briefly. 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Chip Lazier. I'm Vice President of J.E. Dunn Construction. Chairman, members of the committee, I've passed out what I'm talking about today, plus a letter along with some other letters from firms that also, from CEOs and presidents, are also against this measure. J.E. Dunn's been in Portland since 1921. We are a large general contractor, employ quite a few people in the state. We do about $250 million a year here. We're part of a bigger company that does $3 billion a year, and we're the third largest healthcare contractor in the U.S. We strongly object to the bill. For several reasons. One, it causes delays in capital construction projects by our health care providers, resulting in fewer jobs and increased cost of construction. There already exist extensive CON processes and local jurisdictional processes, design reviews, where the public has the ability to provide input on any given project. We really don't see the value that this adds to the process, and as I mentioned, there's already well-defined land use processes to consider for healthcare projects publicly. With that, I appreciate you listening to my testimony today and answer any questions you might have.
I just have a brief question. You talk about land use regulations. The land use regulations deal with issues of the effect on the healthcare system of building facilities.
Yeah, when you go to build a project, it'll go through a land use and also a design review process where the public has opportunity for, they have to hold public hearings.
But the criteria around land use relate to land use, comprehensive plan, and other kind of rules. They don't necessarily rate the effect of the facility on the healthcare system, do they?
I'm probably not qualified to answer that question directly to you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is obviously a complex and controversial subject, but I'm wondering, under the current system, do employers, who of course pay the vast majority of health care costs, or individuals who themselves may be paying some of the health care costs, have the opportunity to formally question, challenge, deny an application by a health care provider, hospital for instance, to build a new facility? Is there any point in the process where an employer or a group of employers could say, you know what, we're paying too much already for health care, we can't afford another increase, and we want the opportunity to at least evaluate the impact that this new construction project will have on the rates that we pay?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Dave Fiskum for Providence Health System. I think the answer is perhaps. Maybe it's yes. It's yes if the proposal is, under Oregon law, a new hospital or a new nursing home. CON regulations currently pertain to those two kinds of facilities, and thus when there is a new hospital recommended, and that occurs fairly rarely, as a matter of fact, over a number of years, as we've had a conversation, Representative Cannon, in your office, there is clearly an opportunity then in a formal way under that state process. Otherwise, I just wanted to read you, or encourage you to read, if not read, the third paragraph of the letter from Mr. Danielson on this subject, where he says, once we decide that community health care needs would best be met by renovating or constructing a new building, albeit not a hospital, planning and local government approvals can take from 6 months to 2 years. Across Oregon, well-respected and effective local government and land use processes exist for new construction. Through these steps, local jurisdictions have full review of the planned project, including hearings and many opportunities for public comment, questions, and refinements of projects. And those issues go beyond just simply and only land use considerations, though that may be the focus. And then Mr. Danielson adds a last sentence, which is very important, especially in a place like Providence Portland Medical Center, where this has happened in a routine fashion. We also reach out to neighborhood associations and community planning organizations to engage and inform our neighbors about projects in their area. Let me just add one other comment, and Tom would be in, and some, well, Mr. Holt would be in a better position to amplify on this. But in the Senate, we have dealt with this issue now for several weeks, if not months. There's a compromise that's been worked out with a number of interests, Mr. Holt on behalf of hospitals, the state relative to a requirement that will find its way into law, I believe, for organizations, and there are various threshold requirements that Tom can recite better than me, where you are, if a hospital system or a healthcare system is planning a development, a new project, those will be posted on the hospital's own website, and in turn, the state will, the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research will have access to that information and can, in fact, post that information on its own website in the spirit of transparency. That's the goal, and there were a number of threshold criteria for projects that were worked out in that Senate bill, which I believe is moving and eventually will reach the House. Mr. Holt can amplify on that. So I think, Representative Cannon, the answer to your question is yes, there's ample opportunity for comment.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, if I may, again, for the record, Tom Holt for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Just to amplify a little bit on Dave's comments, in Senate Bill 454, which this committee adopted as an amendment into House Bill 2009, we came to some agreements around reporting of capital projects. Where in a project of value 5% or more of gross patient revenue for a type A or type B hospital, or 1.75% for a DRG hospital, the DRGs being hospitals of more than 50 beds, would do a report, as Mr. Fiskum described, on its own website, invite public comment through that mechanism, also report it to the Oregon Office of Health Policy and Research, where they would aggregate the information and make it known. That was a compromise. A similar bill to 3261, Senate Bill 798, is at this point dead, not having been noticed or heard on the Senate side. That was, you know, really part of that overall discussion. But I also wanted to answer a little more directly your question, Representative Cannon, on, you know, input from payers. While there may or may not be formal means for payers to engage in a process on construction at this point, there is a great deal of informal back and forth that goes on. People do not just sit in a room and say, gee, it'd be really neat to have a new cardiac unit or a new cancer unit. Discussions do occur with payers. Market research is done because these are large projects that cost a fair amount of money, and that money doesn't get invested lightly, either from reserves or through fundraising or other means. And so the hospitals generally seek wide feedback on large-scale projects of the sort that you described in your question.
Thank you very much, folks.
Oh, Tina, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I don't know where to start, but I do want to say, since you brought up the third paragraph in your letter, Mr. Fiscom, so the very first line, it says, once we decide that community health care needs would be best met by renovating or constructing a new building, blah, blah, blah. Who's the we there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, it's clearly in this case, in this letter, Providence Health System. We run a major system in the state with 16,000 employees, seven hospitals, a health insurance plan, a number of special programs. We're obviously running that system with an eye toward consumer interest and demand and serving the public that depends on us for health care needs. Perhaps it's possible to contend, in light of your question, that the word decide is a little strong there, because we decide to go forward with a proposal. We don't decide to go do something with no input, with the unilaterally making a decision. We go forward to decide to go through a process whereby a final decision is reached about what kind of investments to make for the benefit of the public through a process that's described in the rest of that paragraph.
Mr.
So it's a proposal, not an ultimate final decision.
Yes,
Mr. Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Fiscom. So I guess I just want to clarify, because what I'm having trouble with all the testimonies here is that none of you, though you're making arguments, have pointed out to things that you disagree with the bill. So I just want to be clear. Page 1, line 8, this bill would establish guidelines for local planning processes to guide local health care planning commissions in assessing health care needs and in generating plans for ensuring access to health services while avoiding unnecessary and costly duplication of services in the health care service delivery areas. Does Providence oppose the bill because of that line?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, we don't oppose the bill because of any single line. We oppose the bill in its entirety on its merits, or in our case, its demerits. We do not believe that expanded certificate of need regulations have proven effective in controlling health care costs as those regulations associated with the attachments to our letter have proven around the country. It's a difference of opinion about government regulation. It may be a friendly difference of opinion. We can agree to disagree. We're opposed to House Bill 3261 or its Senate counterpart. And because of that opposition, we have worked closely to devise a work group compromise solution making its way to you for your consideration. We've done that in the Senate because of the interest in the Senate in dealing with this issue. So we have not analyzed House Bill 3261 word by word. We've analyzed the bill on its face and said we oppose it.
I'm sorry. So you're bringing forth a compromise on revision of the certificate of need process?
Yes, as Mr. Holt described.
You described 454. That's
exactly.
Not a revision of the certificate.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, if I may, the Senate Bill 454 originally contained a process very much, at least from our point of view, that looked a lot like a certificate of need process. It required public hearings for construction projects, and there were some other requirements. Those elements of the bill were taken out and replaced with the reporting requirements that I described a moment ago. The Hospital Association opposes 3261 in its entirety. We believe in general that it sets up an unnecessarily adversarial process for new projects, and one that would be complex and one that would be very costly. And the evidence suggests, and we talk a lot around here about evidence-based medicine, the evidence in terms of the regulation in this case is that it would mostly add cost and time and increase risk of investment in projects in the early phases and being lost, because we would eventually get to a point where a local commission would say, gee, no thanks. And we don't think that's good public policy.
Well, of course, some of us would think that this kind of planning process would keep us from potentially building projects that there is no need for in the community, or different types of facilities. So we just have a difference of opinion. I have not seen your evidence of the fact that this would somehow add additional cost. I'm not convinced. There are land use issues that slow down construction projects more than I think this would. And this is pre-land use. This is about deciding what is good healthcare system expansion in the state of Oregon, and that's what this is trying to get at. It might not be perfect, but we obviously have a difference of opinion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, can I make one quick qualification? Representative Kotek, if I misspoke, what I should have said is that what Providence Health System is in favor of, in light of the 454 process for the last weeks, is additional capital project reporting. And that may not be CON, and I apologize if I misspoke in that regard a few minutes ago.
Quite all right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, I'm willing to let this go along just a little bit more.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I don't know what happens in Portland, but I've been on two different committees, one to build a brand-new hospital from the ground up, and one through a foundation. The other is through an expansion and a rebuild of Rogue Valley Medical Center in Medford. And those projects first came as a conversation between the board and the executive staff, and then between the executive staff and the board and the foundation, and the board of that organization are business people and community members, local. I know them, they're my friends, to include Bill Thorndike, which is on Oregon Health Fund Board. And after that, without the community buy-in and the community pulling out their checkbook and writing big checks to the foundation to support these billing projects, they didn't happen, or they wouldn't have happened. And it was only with community support that, in fact, these projects grew traction and were completed. I don't know what happens in Portland, but I tell you, in the rural communities that were out of Portland, maybe even out of Eugene, that, in fact, without the community there, these things don't happen because they won't give money. And if there's without the philanthropic arm to make these projects get over the top, then it doesn't happen. So I absolutely oppose the bill, because the last thing we need is piling on. We need to peel back the onion. Let's get back to the core functions of what a business should be.
Okay. Can I excuse you? We'll get up another panel in a moment.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for your attention.
I temporarily want to close this hearing, and I want to let a couple of folks know that I am going to carry over 2, 3, 4, 5. I don't have the fiscal on it. I do want to... That's an important bill to us. I think we're working along.
Carry it over to Monday.
Carry it over until Monday. And the other bill I want to carry over until Monday is House Bill 2604. I have word that I have agreement from OMA to move an amendment to this, which is what we need. The only amendment will delete the requirement that the medical board remove information from their website after 4 years, allow the medical board to keep information on their website about disciplinary actions. That's the only piece of that bill that's left. I think I've heard it is okay, but we'll get back to it on Monday. That is carried over. So both 2, 3, 4, 5 and 2604 is carrying over until Monday. Is there anybody else out there? Jim, I would like you here. Don't go away. Yeah, and the next panel, the only two I have left, and again, brief, Bob Shipwreck and Grant, do you still want to comment on this?
I also have some letters to read into the record.
I still see Bob out there.
A letter dated April 21st, 2009, from David Anderson, president of Anderson Construction Company. A letter dated April 24th from Richard Roach, president of Western Partitions. A letter dated April 24th from Chip Lazar, vice president.
Hold on a moment. Hold on a moment. Excuse me. We don't have a fiscal. We're going to carry it over. Did I announce 3175? To carry over? Okay, I am announcing now we are carrying over 3175. Again, waiting for fiscal. Carry it over. I'm sorry, please continue.
I also have a letter dated April 22nd from Todd Dew, Vice President of Inline Commercial Construction, and I have a letter dated March 21st, 2009 from John Juergens, John R. Juergens and Associates.
Did we lose Bob? Okay. Bob Shipwreck, we don't have. You please go.
Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Public Health Division, Department of Human Services, and my office is responsible for the Certificate of Need program. And basically, I wanted to come up primarily so I could submit the written testimony, but I did want to say a couple of things. One is the department is neutral on this bill, but I do appreciate the fact that you're discussing this because I do think it really is a important policy issue to be discussed. You know, do we expand certificate of need and have a regulatory approach to control health care costs and improve quality, or do we leave that up to the marketplace as we have done for the past couple of decades? And the only other things I want to say is I do need to respond to a couple things that were said by the other panel. One is that Mr. Fiskum said that at the current time that only new long-term care facilities and acute care facilities are under a certificate of need, and that's not totally correct. On the long-term care side of things, we actually have a fairly robust certificate of need program. We not only do new facilities, but any significant expansion of beds or of services is also under certificate of need. When you look at the acute care side, that is only for hospitals, and when you look across the 36 states that have CN programs, that's a very narrow scope for acute care facilities compared to other states. And then the other thing I wanted to comment on was that I did testify on Senate Bill 454 and did make the point that that is a public hearing, public input process, that it is not a certificate of need process because there's no regulatory teeth behind it. So with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. There'll be plenty of questions before we're done with this topic. And Mr. Shipwreck is not available but did want us to note his position in opposition to the bill. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3261. Open a work session on House Bill 3261 and request a motion to move it to Ways and Means with the permission of the Speaker with rules.
We need to suspend the rules. We don't have a fiscal revenue on this.
Do we need a fiscal revenue to move it to Ways and Means? Yes. I mean
to rules.
To
no,
rules?
We don't.
No, I don't think
Excuse
we do.
Me. No, you don't.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3261 to the Committee on Rules without recommendation.
Is there any discussion on that motion? Can I have a roll call, please?
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Demereaux?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnamer?
Aye.
Representative Kotak?
No.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. House Bill 3261 moves to rules. We moved 3175. Carry over. Don't go away. I'm going to carry over House Bill 2007 to Monday. Just as 3175 is carried over to Monday. Representative Kotak, which is the one that... Oh, no, wait a minute. I'm going to open a brief public hearing on 3257. Do we have anybody signed up for 3257? Okay. Can I have Bob Demick? Is all on 3257, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Dumig with Oregon Health and Science University. To be brief, I've submitted testimony. OHSU supports the intent and the spirit of this bill. We do have some issues with the way it's written, but have spoken with the sponsors of the bill. We have begun to have some discussion and believe that if the committee does decide to move it forward, we'll continue to work with them at the next committee.
And what are your, just briefly, what are the issues?
Briefly, the issues are that currently the state gives us around $2 million for our graduate medical education. OHSU spends slightly over $17 million on that. We have about 100 slots every year for primary care positions that come open in our primary care area. So we spend, as is, far more than we get this, from the state on those slots. And to change how we pay them would not, in fact, increase the slots of primary care. It would cause an imbalance in the way that they're dealt with at this point. We do have a proposal and have got the amendments that we will move forward if the chair decides to move the bill to look at how we have started to work with the other communities where there are hospitals to increase the number of GME slots for primary care as opposed to just reshuffling the dollars over there.
Do you have any trouble filling the slots?
Not at all. We have far more people than we have slots.
So motivating people to apply for the slots by giving them more money using is not the way to spend the money. The way to spend the money is to open up more slots.
Exactly.
And is it feasible to open up more slots?
It is feasible. OHSU has been working with various facilities in the state to come up with a way to do so. We do have language. It does cost money, but it is a feasible thing to do. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dimmitt. Mm-hmm. I think what we'll do right now is carry this bill over to Monday. Mr. Dimmitt, could you talk with the sponsors and with Representative Kotek as well and see if it's feasible enough to do these things, to move it to rules and have time to work on it there, or if
it's got a referral to Ways.
Yeah, I know it does, but I don't want to send it to Ways and Means in this form, but I might want to send it to Ways and Means in a different form. So if you would get permission just in case to send it to rules so we can keep it alive, if we decide that's worth doing on Monday, that would be helpful. And you'll check in with the sponsors and with Representative Kotek on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We are carrying over 3257 to Monday. Okay. Representative Kotek, I'm getting lost here. What's the bill number on the surgical checklist bill?
Oh, 2129.
2129. Okay, I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2129, and I'd like the Hospital Association and I'd like Mr. Dameron to join us for a minute to answer a couple questions. And Tom, you have a letter on this one. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Mr. Chair, at your request, we have prepared a letter and provided it to the committee through staff outlining our work that is underway on a surgical checklist. And I would point out that we have a number of other organizations involved in this, and just to refresh your memories from the last time we discussed this, this is a checklist based on the Institute for Healthcare Improvements work out of the World Health Organization, and our partner organizations in this are Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Nurses Association, and we've also had discussions with the Oregon Patient Safety Commission, Cure Oregon, and Acumentra Health, and that's all outlined in the letter. It's on our letterhead, but all those organizations have reviewed the letter and have agreed that it's an accurate reflection of the work that is ongoing and that we expect to be completed by the end of this year.
You're working on that too, aren't you, Mr. Dameron? Could you identify yourself?
I'm Jim Dameron. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. So from the commission's point of view, at issue here is how best to make the surgical checklist a reality in Oregon. Everyone agrees, I believe, that this is a good idea. The evidence that we have suggests it can reduce surgical complications, reduce mortality 30 to 40%. So the question really, again, is, not should we do this in Oregon, but how we should do it in Oregon. And if I have concerns, it's about can you, should you mandate a specific quality improvement activity in this manner. So that's my concerns. And but we are there. I think it's important, as Mr. Holt was pointing out, there is an awful lot of activity right now to make the surgical checklist in Oregon a reality. The Patient Safety Commission Board of Directors in February endorsed the use of the surgical checklist. It went on record in February as saying we the commission, are going to promote its active use in Oregon hospitals. The Hospital Association, Acumentra, Care Oregon, Oregon Nurses Association, many folks have embraced this approach. So one could argue, I would argue, that at least for this project, there's an awful lot of energy around making it a reality in a voluntary, consensual way. That isn't always the case, but this has generated some enthusiasm. So, and we are also doing a survey of hospitals to see if there's any bark behind the talk, or if there's any, if there, what's the reality? So we're saying the question on the table, and we're gathering information right now, is: are you doing it? What are you doing? How far along are you? So we'll have a benchmark to see. Well, is this in fact is it really happening as we believe it's happening in Oregon hospitals? So back to the original question: we support the project. I have concerns about whether you should mandate it in this manner.
All right. I think the sponsors are satisfied that things are moving forward, but I am going to... Yes?
Quick question.
Yes.
You mentioned that survey that you're conducting to see what's actually happening. How far along are you in that? And do you have data that...
We don't have data yet. I would expect in another couple of weeks we should have a fair sense of where we are.
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, I just point out that the initial test sledding of this just began on April 1st, so it's we are just beginning to get back the first wave of information. This will be an iterative process through the remainder of the year, but we do fully expect that it will be completed by year's end. And as Mr. Dameron said, there's a great deal of enthusiasm behind this, and we really do believe that all hospitals are going to adopt whatever ultimately the experts determine ought to be the list. So we appreciate the issue being brought forward. And, Mr. Chair, I'll just repeat our offer that in the interim, when we're further along, I think we would be absolutely delighted to come back and report on our progress.
Thank you. It's my intention to get permission to move this bill to rules. It has such a handy relating to clause that we may need to further our work later in the session, and I will try and get permission for that so we can do that on Monday. In the meantime, I'm going to carry over House Bill 2129.
Mr. Chair, may I just make a comment before we do that?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you to Tom for the letter written from the association about where you are. You took the discussion in good faith the other day, went and got this. I really do appreciate that, and I really appreciate the testimony from Mr. Dameron. I'm excited that there's interest in doing this. I reserve the right, I think, if we're not in moving on a requirement like this, that in the interim we hear back, and maybe we're going to find out a year from now that this is great, we want to be doing it, and we have some hospitals who are dragging their feet, and then I think we have a different conversation. But it sounds like we have a lot of interest in doing this. You have a process. And we're going to have a survey. So I just want to thank you, the partners and the colleagues, for letting us discuss what I think is a helpful tool to, lower costs and improve patient safety. So thank you.
Thank you.
My question is, I don't think state government is the right vehicle, but JCO probably, if the research supports it, is probably going to say this is a standard practice, and look for these checklists in the various areas of the hospital that it's appropriate? Is there a comment to that?
Representative Greenlake, or Chair Greenlake, Representative Maurer, I believe there already is a sort of minimal requirement under JCO. This work is building quite a ways further beyond that. Right. And I would fully expect them, as they have in the past, to ramp up their requirement in response.
And they ramp up pretty quick, don't they?
They sure do.
They do.
It's their business.
Okay, I am going to close the work session on House Bill 2129. We have House Bill 3418, which is developing payment systems. We are waiting for a fiscal on that. Is that right? There's also amendments.
Which one?
3418.
Yes, we're waiting for the fiscal.
We are waiting for a fiscal on 3418. So I will carry 3418 over until Monday. Monday might be a busy day. I will also carry.
Finally.
We're off Wednesday and Friday, so you get comp time. I will carry over House Bill 2117 to Monday. And I think that takes care of one side of my page. We'll verify in a minute.
Did you
I think we carried that over, did we not?
No, we didn't.
I don't think so.
2656. I will carry over House Bill 2656 until until Monday. House Bill 2656 is carried over till Monday. I'm going to carry over House Bill 3260 to Monday.
3262.
I'm sorry, 3262. I'm getting rummy here. I've already done 2007, right? I've already done 3257.
Yes.
3262.
I've already done 3175. It's waiting for a fiscal.
Haven't done 2019, I think.
We're waiting for fiscal.
No, we're waiting for a letter from the speaker on that, I think. I will carry over 3028, my intention, 29. My intention is to move that to rules.
That was 2019.
I don't think we
need. Bottom two.
Yeah, I don't think we need 2-8. 2850 still alive in anybody's mind? I don't think it is.
I think it is. There's an amendment.
There is an amendment?
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about it in a minute.
Okay.
And I will move 3,000 to rules when I get... I will carry over 3,000 to Monday, again with the intention of carrying it, of moving it to rules. I think we've done everything on the next page.
Is that right? 3023?
That's one of you said you were going to let it die if you hadn't carried it over.
Yeah, 3723, I'm not carrying over.
3023.
The one on the top of the page. Not opening it, not carrying it over. Not opening it and not carrying it over.
You said
3023.
Thank you. Sorry.
What's going on with 2850? Where are we with that?
Mr. Chair, 2850 has a -2 amendment, which I just learned hasn't been distributed yet. My apologies for that. With a -2, basically this is the get-her-done bill for interoperable medical health records, the end of December 2015. What the -2 amendments do is, and I don't have it in front of me because I give it to Laura, but basically says that that everything that is done will be in conformity with the 2009 federal stimulus package, the interoperable health care provision within that, as well as, and I'm the language is a little more complex than this. I'm getting rummy too, Mr. Chair. But says that this committee, as it's engaging its work, will look at best practices. And there were some advocates out there that wanted that language in there.
Do we have a fiscal on this?
We have a revenue, and we've requested the fiscal. We haven't received it yet.
And on the dash twos?
Yeah.
Okay, let's carry over 2850 and see if we get a fiscal. We may not get 850 and see if we get a fiscal. We may not get a fiscal on some of these, I'm afraid, and if we don't, then they die. But we're trying. Carry that over. I think we're done. Is that right?
Yes.
Sir. You want to... Yes. Do we want to, for the record, just go through the list that I have?
Would you be at ease while I check with Laura?
Let's check at ease. Let's stand at ease. It's not even 6 o'clock. We're going to be out of here. I think you guys can go.